4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural revolution. 250. Industrial revolution.
Civilization.
Great acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we explore the new geologic age. Thanks for tuning in. Stay with us. Hi, this is Mike Osborne, and I'm the creator and co-producer of Generation Anthropocene, along with Miles Traer. So what is the Anthropocene? I think it'll become clear, but the basic idea is that we've entered a new geologic age based upon the global footprint of humankind. It's as if we, as a species, have had such a profound impact on the planet that we actually constitute a geologic force or a geologic event, like an ice age or an asteroid hitting the Earth. If you accept this concept, then one of the questions that comes up is, where would you place the boundary? Does it begin when Homo sapiens first appear in the evolutionary tree? Is it the agricultural revolution, or the industrial revolution, or what some people call the Great Acceleration after World War II? This might be just an academic question, but I think this debate matters. I think that where you place the boundary actually says a lot about you and your perception of the planet's natural resources. So I told my students to go out and find Stanford faculty who are thinking about 21st century environmental issues. Organically, this project evolved into something truly interdisciplinary. We talked to geologists, engineers, ecologists, doctors, project managers, oceanographers, and historians. The students were in charge of preparing for their interviews, but I made them ask this one question of all their subjects. Where would you place the boundary? And after listening to all 14 interviews, we had the idea to string excerpts together into a compilation. That's what you're about to hear. Now, this is not meant as a highlight reel. Many of our favorite moments are not included, and our hope is that this piece will inspire you to explore our full-length interviews available at stanford.edu/group/anthropocene. Our story is broken into three segments. In Chapter 1, we start with the Anthropocene and our changing perceptions of the environment. Chapter 2 is a reflection on where environmentalism is today. In Chapter 3, we return to the question of the Anthropocene boundary and what it means to be living in a new geologic age. The premise of the Anthropocene is that our world has changed in a fundamental way, and there's a lot of lip service that gets paid to the moral aspects of environmentalism. The next generation is going to live on a planet that is very different from the world we live in now. For us, the most powerful quality of this story is that the contributors are responding to this reality, and the students are asking the questions on behalf of their generation. They're trying to make sense of this. Keep that in mind as you listen. Chapter 1. Perceptions.
Ecologist and IPCC lead author Terry Root on the Anthropocene and where she would place the boundary.
Anthropocene, I think, is a fantastic word because it really sets in your mind the fact that humans are affecting the globe. I really do think it's a paradigm change. It's making people realize that humans actually can affect the ground, the water, the air, everything. And it's something that people really need to be aware of. Because they're not, if we don't tell them. I really don't know where people set it, but since I work on climate change, where I would set it would be around the middle of the 1700s, and because that's basically the start of the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. and that's when we really started affecting our atmosphere.
Environmental historian Richard White on the ambiguity of the Anthropocene boundary.
Well, it's very difficult to do because at some days I would say, if let's say we're going to consider global warming the beginning of humans dominating a geological age. Well, do you start it when we first start burning coal, even though nobody's really recognized it until later? Do you do it when, in fact, you have a certain degree of temperature change? I mean, if you're going to say that, well, geological eras, where do you mark the beginning? Has it begun yet? Or did it begin 100 years ago, but we didn't know it? If you're going to say it's human influence over the environment, where, in fact, humans are a huge factor, then I think you have to go back a long, long way to when human beings start using fire and start reshaping the world, domesticating animals, bringing about extinctions. All of those things are clearly human impacts.
Tropical evolutionary biologist Rodolfo Durso.
Given the fact that climate change is such a visible problem and it's such a publicized problem, I think that a lot of the general public and certainly a great proportion of the scientists actually think of a sort of a good indicator or a good or a very typical element that describes the Anthropocene is climate change. Mm-hmm. But I would like to really emphasize that climate change is just one of the several global environmental changes. And the reason why I wanted to emphasize that is because climate change is certainly a very important problem, but it's a problem that probably is going to be interacting with other drivers of global change. Mm-hmm. But from the point of view of biological diversity, I think there is a very, very crucial component of the global environmental change and that characterizes the Anthropocene, and that is biological extinction.
Environmental historian John Christensen on humankind's far-reaching impacts.
You know, the arrival of the Anthropocene is kind of that sense that really there is nowhere that is not affected by people. You know, I think if we think about it as the period in which the Earth is affected by people, that's very, very difficult to say when it began. You know, is it when human beings began using fire to alter their landscapes, to manage their landscapes, and thus change the balance between grasslands and forests in favor of grasslands and begin to alter the atmosphere? Is it the arrival of agriculture, the Industrial Revolution, you know, the later periods of the Industrial Revolution when we see, you know, a pretty big turning point in the mid-20th century with dramatically increasing levels of CO2 affecting the atmosphere, this human production. I think fire would be a really important marker of that because, you know, it begins to manage landscapes on a very grand scale, you know, with people lighting fire to the landscape to manage Aboriginal, Native American. It's a basic human tool for managing landscapes is using fire. Mm-hmm. To favor certain species that we favor, that whether it's, you know, the grasslands or the animals that live in the grasslands that we hunt and eat, and then bringing fire inside, bringing fire then inside our machines to run our machines, that really begins to accelerate the way in which we see human beings shaping the planet as a whole.
Anthropologist Doug Bird on his studies of the native Martu peoples of Australia and their perceptions of environment.
Martu notions of country and home, which for them the word is exactly the same. Nura, wow. That your home, your place, your hearth, is a vast country. Your backyard is the size of the state of Wyoming. And there are, on any given day, about 300 people who live and operate in that. And they know every single inch of that land. And it is indeed sacred. It houses all of the chukurba, the law and the mm-hmm. ceremony that sustains them. And it literally does sustain the land in that sense. It requires all of the proper treatment of resources and people. They, through their daily processes of caring for country, modify the landscapes to a great extent. They create their environments, and those environments sustain them. And they do so by way of applying fire in the course of their hunting activities.
historian Richard White on Western perceptions of the environment.
In modern environmentalism, this sense that what you're dealing with is a pristine world, which if you leave it alone, it will revert back to this perfect balance, is precisely a factor that they don't intervene and they don't actually live in that world except as in recreation and leisure. Precisely because they've lost the contact through work, they're able to imagine that when you go into a national park, you're seeing an untouched landscape. You're seeing nothing of the sort. You're seeing an historical landscape, which has been brought back into being precisely because you've instituted certain management patterns. And once you remove yourself from it, you begin to think this is pure nature, which will operate as long as you keep human beings from intervening in it. It's really hard to imagine how you can condone human beings who you think are messing it up by simply acting as being human beings. But what you've done is you've invented a world. It's a fantasy world. It's a world which hasn't existed in the United States for a very long time. And I would say now, particularly with global warming, doesn't exist any place in the world. We have now touched virtually everything except maybe some of the deepest parts of the ocean.
I think they've been ignored because, well, for one thing, you can't see. I mean, you can see the ocean, but you can't see the effects we have on the ocean.
Polar oceanographer Kevin Arrigo.
It's really easy to look at a parcel of land and, you know, if we've cut the trees down or we've, you know, turned a forest into a cropland, we know that. In the ocean, it's, you know, our effects are almost invisible, and they're below the surface, and you can't see them. And the other thing is the ocean is just this vast area that people assume that, you know, we can dump anything we want in there, and the ocean is going to just happily absorb it, and it's not going to have any effect. And that's not the case. And I think more and more people are becoming to realize that, you know, the ocean is not an infinite, you know, dumping ground for whatever we want to put in it.
Historian Richard White on the misconception of natural landscapes.
I mean, it's one of the things that used to bother me when I was younger, because in fact, I don't think I entirely ever succumbed to that. So I'd be backpacking with friends, and we'd be in wilderness areas, and they'd be fantasizing that they're the first human beings who have ever touched this, and this is what it looked like 150 years ago, and I'd be thinking, you're nuts. It's beautiful. I mean, I want to protect it, but this is not, you haven't walked back into the past. You haven't reached an untouched nature. Realizes what you're there is not some internal verity, that you're not seeing something that this is the way it is, the way it's always has been, and the way it always has to be. You see it more like you see human beings. You see something as having come to life at one time, going through a series of changes, and someday will vanish. You value it very, very fully, but you don't take it as this sort of eternal past, you know, that it's the earth too changes. Now this is the speed of change is what matters. I mean, we're in a time where the planet seems to be changing much more quickly than ever before. But even when I think about that, I think about, well, there's been periods that are rare, the extinction of the dinosaurs, asteroids hitting the Earth, volcanic eruptions, the way in which carbon dioxide and oxygen first come into the atmosphere, that all of this has been this long process of change. What's so interesting about the present is we have speeded this up in a way that rarely has been seen before in the planet's history. But nothing's new, but the speed is astonishing.
Ecologist Terry Root.
I work on how plants and animals are affected by climate change. And what I have found is that in all of my work and in all of the work that other people are doing on this topic, I'm finding that we are facing a lot of extinctions in the future. And I, like many, many, many other biologists, believe that we are standing right at the edge of a new mass extinction.
And so mass extinctions are really recognized on two criteria.
Geologist and paleobiologist John Payne.
One, did the diversity change from one time interval to another? And then second, was that diversity change driven largely by an elevated rate of extinction or a reduced rate of origination, a reduced rate of new taxa coming into the geological record?
Terry Root on her approach to species conservation.
And so what we need to do is sit down and figure out which species to really work on and try to save. And so it's very similar to what happened in France during the war, when they had a limited number of doctors and a whole lot of injured soldiers. And the doctors, before they would go out onto the field, what they would do would be try and figure out the method by which they would decide which individuals to work on. So they divided them up into three different groups. One was a group that didn't need immediate treatment at all. They could wait for quite a while. They put them in one group. The second group was the group that had people in it that they could save them, but it would take them many, many, many hours to save them. And while they're working on those people, many of the other people would die. So they decided that a person that took a lot of time to work on to make sure that they would survive, they couldn't do that. They had to triage them and they had to say, we're going to make them comfortable, but we have to let them die. And then the other group was the group that they could work on and they could save in a fairly short period of time. I think the same thing now needs to go on for species. I think what we need to do is we need to say there's a group of species we don't need to worry about. But then there's this other group that no matter what we do, we're really not going to be able to save them, or we're going to put so much money, time, energy, effort into saving them that we're not going to have the time, energy, and effort to spend on other species. So I think we need to say we've got to let them go. And then we have to really concentrate on the ones that we do think we can save and that we need to save. And that's how I define my triage issue.
Rodolfo Durso.
I think that given time and political will and political savviness and things like that, we might be able to fix the climate change situation, given the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Those things could be potentially fixed, but biological extinction is not a reversible thing.
I truly am surprised that this is where I am right now. I mean, if you had told me even 5 years ago that I would be saying we need to deal with triage, I would tell you you were crazy. There was a different time when I really thought that if we worked hard enough, we could save all the species on the planet. I truly believe that. I think the change occurred when I realized that we already were causing species to go extinct. We've lost a lot of species already. And if you look at what was actually causing those extinctions, it's been hunting, it's been habitat destruction. I thought we could actually address those. But now that I'm working on climate change, you have climate change on top of habitat destruction and invasive species and the like. And you have species that are having to deal with all of these pressures, and it's just almost impossible to do that. With life the way it is right now, we can't do anything but lose species. So that's just how it's going to end up, I think. There's an immoral aspect to what humans are doing to the world. And I think it is really wrong that one species, the human species, could be causing the extinction of half or over half of the species that exist on the planet right now. So it's a very sobering, it's a very depressing way to think about what's going on in the world. Yeah.
Human ecologist Bill Durham on an interdisciplinary approach.
Gone are the days when anthropology can exist over there in the anthropology department and biology can exist in the biology department and we can both get together for an occasional conference. We have got to break down the disciplinary barriers. You know, if you really want to study sort of the human problems, you need to have not just a smattering of social science, not just a smattering of biological science, but, you know, you really need to build within yourself a dialogue of the two. So I think it's good to work in collaborative groups. I think that's a really good way forward. But I think each of us should also establish that collaborative dialogue within ourselves to engage the best tools of thinking in the social and natural sciences. Because I think it's that dialogue that generates a creative understanding of problems and will lead to better and more profound solutions than we've seen in the development models of the past or in the economic programs of the past. We're just going to have to get beyond so much of that old way of thinking. It's hard because disciplines are still out there and there are a lot of people that will fight forever to defend those old boundaries and all of that. But let's face it, the problems of the world don't recognize those boundaries. They don't recognize disciplines. So if we're going to try and solve some things around here, we're going to have to learn really to open up those boundaries and work across them.
Chapter 2, A New Environmentalism.
Environmental historian John Christensen on overpopulation.
Yeah, I think that's the, what is it? You know, the 9 billion person question, you know, for our century. We were the, you know, the population of the Earth is expected to grow from 7 to 9, maybe 10 billion. Most of that, actually all of that population growth is expected to end up in cities over the next 40, 50 years. That means that, you know, we just went through this huge demographic transition globally where half of the people on Earth now live in urban areas. All of the future growth is one way or another going to be absorbed in urban areas. And most of those urban areas are not going to be the glamorous megacities of Tokyo and New York, London. They're going to be cities of 200,000, you know, dozens, hundreds of these cities we've never even heard of that over the next half century are going to grow to 700,000 to a million people. And I think that the way that those cities grow and absorb that population, expand and grow, thereby affect the environment around them, the suburbs or shanty towns or the agricultural landscapes or the wild landscapes or the protected areas, you know, that they're going to grow up against or maybe even take over, that the next 50 years is going to determine so much about the future of life on Earth for people and, you know, the way that we live, our relations with each other and with nature, as well as the natural landscapes or those kind of hybrid landscapes of people and nature. That's the big question, you know, for your generation.
Environmental engineer Gil Masters on green infrastructure.
The building sector, I've always focused on the residential scale of buildings, and it is a sector that's easy to get your hands around and your arms around. Everyone understands what their house does for them. You turn on the lights, you heat your rooms, you cool your rooms, you eat there. Somewhere along the way, you begin to realize that energy use in residences is a very significant part of our energy consumption in the country. And energy consumption in buildings in general is a very significant driver of our climate problems, of our emissions of carbon dioxide. The starting point for me in a lot of this is just realizing that 40% of our carbon emissions in the United States are associated with operating buildings. And the larger fraction of that is for residential buildings than for commercial. And when you include embodied energy in buildings and some of the energy for lighting and whatever in industrial buildings, it's very close to half of all of our carbon emissions in this country are associated with buildings. And so it's a great area to be looking at if you're concerned about climate change and what we can do to try to slow it down or, you know, deal with the issues that are going to arise as a result.
Environmental engineer Leonard Ortolano on American environmental regulation.
Well, in terms of environmental impact assessment work, yes. The U.S. was a model. It no longer is a model. It was a model through the 1980s, I would say. And maybe the last great thing that happened, I mean, if you look, Superfund was pathbreaking. Well, first of all, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, all pathbreaking. The Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, also pathbreaking. Superfund legislation, pathbreaking. And then the last thing that I would consider to be up there as a model would be the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, which set up the cap and trade program for sulfur dioxide. After that, it's been kind of static, I would say. I don't want to say a downhill slide, but it's been static. We are certainly not the world leaders today.
director of the Global Climate and Energy Project, Sally Benson, on the politics of energy.
I don't think we're doing anywhere near enough in this country. And I think that the political climate is absolutely detrimental. You know, I don't know why energy is a partisan issue. I mean, the idea that it's become such a partisan issue is just ridiculous to me, because there are so many reasons why we need to change our energy situation. And sort of regard, you know, whether if your biggest concern is security, well, how do you get more security? Well, you have more domestic energy. Well, what are the big sources of domestic energy? Well, renewables and natural gas. And there's a lot of coal, too. But we have other options here. You know, and you become much more efficient, you know. So if you care about security, that's your answer. Well, if you care about the environment, well, what do? More renewables. And you know, so it's the same answer there. And if you're, you know, interested in the economy, you want low cost solutions. And again, efficiency, you know, energy efficiency can make a huge difference there. So I think it's really, really a big mess. And I think we need to make this so it's not a political football, and we need to do much more on every single front in terms of efficiency, renewables, capturing carbon.
Gil Masters on the future of energy resources.
If you're willing to call it an energy source, energy efficiency is our biggest resource. I mean, we have such potential to reduce our energy demand, not just in houses and larger buildings, but our vehicles and everything else that goes on. So energy efficiency stuff has negative cost, typically, when you do the calculations correctly. So there's so many things that can be done that will save us money and that have enormous potential to decrease the demand.
Leonard Ortolano on the complexities of water resource planning.
The pollution issues are usually not brought up in the same way that you would think about the climate change issue. Climate change issues are more, in some ways, ambiguous, more subtle, less well studied, whereas mm-hmm. pollution issues are more concrete, more highly studied, a lot more is known about them, and it's much more immediate. The challenges with the climate change and the context of water is that we haven't reached a point where we can make predictions that have enough precision that people on the ground doing water resources planning can actually take concrete steps. We have a lot of contingency plans that are beginning to be made. But, you know, unless you know more or less what the changes are in precipitation, it's hard to get too precise about your plans. But it is definitely on the radar screen, mm-hmm. and the water managers in the U.S. are definitely concerned about it. And I would say all over the world, the people interested in water resources are concerned about it.
Agricultural ecologist Patrick Archie on food accessibility and urbanization.
The United Nations estimates that currently approximately 16% of the world's food is being grown within what they call urban agglomerations, which kind of blows people away. That's an immense amount of food. Now, that's mostly in Asia and in Africa, to a certain extent in Latin America. It's also happening increasingly in the more developed countries, too. I think in urban areas in particular, one of the things that we can really do well is grow vitamins and minerals. We can grow greens and vegetables and things that are highly perishable.
Nutritionist Christopher Gardner on his experiences lecturing on food and society.
Here's what's especially fun for me. So for one person, for example, they'll read about animal rights and welfare and they'll say, you know, now that you've pointed this out to me, oh, I can't even bear the thought of looking at that livestock in the eye and eating it. It got treated so miserably. I'm going to eat less fast food, less meat. I just can't do it that way. And right across from a student says, you know, I grew up on a farm. It's not like that. We treated our cattle really well. And, you know, I just don't buy that. If we weren't going to eat them, we wouldn't raise them. And so it's not an animal rights or welfare issue. But that global warming talk we had the other day, oh, I had no idea that the big factory farms are causing that much. They're contributing to greenhouse gases and the methane and the, oh, my gosh. Now I'm going to have to change the way I eat and cut back on meat and have more locally sustained meat. because I'm horrified at what it does to the global warming. And then the student next to them will say, you know, guys, I don't get either of those. But, you know, I'm really into local economy, local sustainable, support your farms. And I really think that we ought to start supporting the local farmers, more local business, not so much exporting overseas and sending our food away. And yet a last one will say, fourth student will say, you know, it's the human labor abuses that get me. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm only going to buy fair trade now. Now that you've explained the whole banana, chocolate, coffee, child slave labor thing, it's like the Nike shoes. Oh, my gosh, I've got to respond to this. I'm going to change the way I eat because of human rights. And so it's been very interesting that it's a different hook for different people.
Agroecologist Patrick Archie, responding to the concern that the sustainable food movement is impractical and is merely symbolic.
That's a great question, and I think I think one of the most important debates of the rest of our lives, actually, and it's playing out right now. And I think that, in my opinion, we already know, as agroecologists, we already know how to feed the world, and we can do it. And it's really more a question of – it's a political question. It's a question of resource use. It's a question of land access. It's a question of how our societies, plural, allocates its resources. We increasingly, and there's more and more research that's coming out and validating sustainable practices that are actually – most likely, given the coming storms of energy crises and climate disruption, our systems again and again show themselves to be more resilient and less energy intensive. So I think this debate will be overcome over a course of time as things change. I think we can help it along, no doubt, by continuing this research. It's interesting that, you know, It is certainly symbolic, like organic, for instance. It's the only sector of agriculture that's growing at an incredibly rapid rate.
Right.
But it's still, you know, depending on what you're talking about, it's 2% to 6%. You know, it's still quite, quite small.
Nutritionist Christopher Gardner.
In class, we talk about some really innovative, interesting, diversified farmers who are trying to bring back the honor and the respect that the innovative, intellectually inspired farmer has. You have to be really clever to grow food under all kinds of conditions, unless you're going to do the monoculture thing with this massive piece of tractor that you just drive back and forth on the field. So in class all the time, we read about some of the really interesting folks. I guess the key word here, and you used it too, diversified farms. So you know, if you go to these factory farms where everything's wrong, they've taken this elegant solution and made two problems out of it. So now they've got all this manure to deal with and no place to put it because they're not growing any produce there. And it's just accumulating. Whereas if you're on the farm, I totally buy this idea that in proper animal husbandry, the livestock are fertilizing the ground and then you're growing plants in the ground. And some of the plants you feed to humans and some of them you feed back to the livestock. And it's a cycle. And if the farmers have diversified livestock and diversified plants or produce and even forest, I've heard even forest is important to have in this diversified situation, then everything thrives and it's more resilient to all kinds of insults from nature, which we've destroyed when we go to monocultures of corn and when we go to these factory farms.
Environmental historian Richard White.
The way I look at these things is that they're, in most of human history, the major way that humans related to nature was they worked in nature. They make a living by altering nature. They make a living by killing animals. They make a living by plowing the earth and putting seeds in the ground. They make a living by cutting down trees and boring into mountains for shelter. That there's never been a time where, in fact, this kind of intimate tie between human life and the natural world hasn't been present. What's happened with modernity is there's a way in which we get removed from all of this, that we can sit in a room like we're sitting in now and think that we're pretty much utterly removed from nature, and that most of us have jobs where what we do is what I'm doing right now. I talk for a living. But what we don't realize is those connections now might be less obvious, but they're still there. The light in this room is coming from a dam, most likely, that is harnessing a river, which is changing the flow, which is altering the habitat for other creatures. Virtually everything in this room is made out of one natural element or another that's been modified. Those ties are always there. So one of the things I try to point out is that even though many people now think that they're utterly removed from nature in the way that they earn their living and the way they live, and they think of those who work in nature, people who still farm or cut trees, is really a minority in a country like the United States. That's just not true. I mean, there's distances between them, but we're all implicated in the natural world.
Chapter 3, The Boundary.
Paleobiologist John Payne on contextualizing the Anthropocene.
Right. So geological boundaries are defined based on fossils. People recognized very early on that by identifying fossils in particular layers of sedimentary rock, that those sequences of fossils were characteristic of the entire planet. And so that you could define geological time in the rocks you were looking at based on the fossils that were in them. The changes associated with the Anthropocene, at least to date, are not nearly of the magnitude that we see at the end of the Permian or the end of the Cretaceous periods. On the other hand, those were really events precipitated by geological processes such as asteroid impacts, volcanic eruptions. The only single sort of biological event that I can think of that one could easily argue had a similar or greater impact on the planet as a whole would be the evolution of oxygenic photosynthesis.
Biologist Rodolfo D'Urso.
If you and people in general, when they look at sort of the geological clock or the geological calendar, when they look for at the moment in which one epoch or period is defined and sort of the boundary and separation from the other, usually we talk about, you know, a number of millions of years. So sometimes the sort of the division is not so sharp. So it is difficult to say, but in the large scheme of things, given the age of the Earth and the age that of the sort of in the time span that we're talking about, which is in essence 3.5 billion years of of life on this planet, the definition of the moment is tricky. But you know, in this case, I think we're really very close to around the moment of the Industrial Revolution, I would say.
Richard White.
We are now certainly the most powerful beings on the planet in terms of influencing change, but we're still beings who are very much subject to natural powers. Every time there's an earthquake, every time a volcano explodes, every time there's a tsunami, all of these things which we didn't cause and can't control, those things remind us we're powerful, but there are deep geological forces we don't control and which really can change things very, very quickly. There's a set of forces deep in the planet which we call geology. And now we're adding human beings for another set of forces, which in some ways are quite distinct. They can have consequences just as great, but whether we then identify them with these deep geological forces, I don't know. I mean, there's something in the historian in me saying, well, these are, you know, all you're doing is they're both consequential, they both change the terms of life, so therefore you're saying they're the same. But I think we might be masking as much as gaining by putting them together. But as I say, it's a question I still think about. It's a very, very interesting one, and I haven't reached a firm conclusion on it yet.
Christopher Gardner.
I mean, my knee-jerk reaction would say that the agricultural revolution, which was centuries ago, was the big deal when we switched from hunter-gatherer to actually growing a lot of crops. But I have a feeling that didn't really change the makeup of the planet all that much, that we weren't polluting and killing off waterways and the atmosphere. It seems like it's when Earl Butz said we should plant fence row to fence row. So as part of a post-war approach to getting enough food to feed our soldiers and our people at home, to be really efficient, get big or get out. Take that farmland you've got and plant it fence row to fence row, which meant diversified farms got wiped out. And we have monocultures of corn and factory farms of livestock. And we've separated that natural symbiotic relationship where one takes care of the other.
John Christensen.
If we think about the Anthropocene as really beginning, or at least our consciousness of it beginning when the idea of the frontier ends. In that sense, I mean, it is as if the idea of the frontier kept open the illusion that there was more nature out there that was as yet, you know, unaffected by human beings. And you know, that's really the myth of the frontier. That really never did exist.
Bill Durham.
You know what I'd like to suggest? That this is really wacky and it probably won't go any place after this conversation, but maybe the right time to put it is the time at which we understand our place in the web of life. So maybe it was Darwin who started it. Because before Darwin, it wasn't possible. We didn't understand that human beings are a part of the tree of life, that all of life is related. And now that we understand that, it seems to me the challenge is upon us to realize our place in this greater picture of life and to realize the responsibility and the responsibility and the privilege that we have to allow and encourage that biodiversity to prosper. Without seeing the connectedness of life, I don't think we really had a way to understand and appreciate and really marvel at how wonderful the rest of biodiversity is. You could make arguments for protecting biodiversity, but to realize that all of life is connected. So maybe I would say a novel way to think of the Anthropocene is to as beginning with this insight that all of life is connected, that human beings did not have a supernatural origin, that we're, you know, a branch on the tip of the tree of life, and to begin to think about that, reflect on that, and use that to shape our relations with the environment and with the rest of life.
John Christensen.
I think we all live in a sense that, you know, with a sense that the world has never been as fast-paced, you know, as confusing, as troublesome, as dangerous, as close to the end times as, you know, any previous generation. And you know, that's a very, very, just a very, very common human feeling and trope throughout history. So I'm a little bit skeptical of it because it's so common. But I think at the same time, I mean, there's no denying that the signs of change in warming, changes in you know, habitat, and in all kinds of measures have been accelerating.
Richard White.
You know, the current political attacks on global warming science are, to me, both predictable but also kind of astonishing, because there does seem to be this belief among certain sectors, some of which I can understand, some of which I can't, that there are no real consequences to these actions.
Terry Root.
There are people who say, don't sugarcoat it, because if you sugarcoat it, people aren't going to realize how dire it is. And then there's people who say, don't tell people how dire it is, because then they're going to be paralyzed and not know what to do. I honestly don't know what the right thing is. And what I do is I try to figure out each time when I'm actually giving a talk or talking to people, trying to figure out which is the best way to go. And I talk to people a lot saying, what did you think of the talk I just gave? Was it too extreme? Was it, you know, the main thing I never do is I work very, very hard at trying not to exaggerate, because the truth is bad enough. You don't need to exaggerate at all.
Historian John Christensen.
I think the Anthropocene begins in a very precise time and place, and it's in 2000 when Paul Kreutzen publishes his essay, Have We Entered the Anthropocene? And the reason why I think it begins at that precise time and place is because I think it's as good a marker as any of how what's important about the Anthropocene may not be when did human beings begin affecting the planet you know, and begin shaping the planet. Because as we talked about, that's so hard to determine, and it's been this continuous process. And to sort of decide one point or another, you can debate about it. But I think the important part of it is, when did we begin to have consciousness of it, to think about it, to begin to talk about it? And that if we define the Anthropocene as beginning, you know, and Paul Crutzen's, you know, article is thought by many people to be, you know, a beginning, although there were some talk of some concepts before that. But right now, it's kind of, it is a marker of when we began to be conscious of it, to debate it, to think about it as the Anthropocene. And I think it's both that reality and the consciousness of it that mark the Anthropocene.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?